Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Thank you for joining us this morning. I'm your host, Bo Spearham. On the program with me this morning, I speak with Adelie Gambangia's sister, Kalisha Morris. It's a two-part interview that I'm going to be doing. So today and tomorrow, you'll hear the interview. We yarn about language revival that she's been a part of for her own self-development, but then also the stuff going on back in the community. She just recently moved back home. We also yarn about NAIDOC and also our young mob, some of the stuff she's doing to make it more accessible for the next generation to come up and learn language, Gambangia language. Just before we start, just got to get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from.
Yeah, Ginnigay. So my name is Kalisha Morris. I'm from Gambangia country on the northern rivers of New South Wales. And I'm also a descendant of the Nagi people in the Torres Strait Islands as well. But I'm pretty much a freshwater woman from Grafton and Coffs Harbour area. So yeah, thanks for having me today.
I wanted to get you on the program this morning just to have a yarn about, you know, the importance of language for yourself. And I guess also, you know, in the context of community, where does that put, you know, I guess yourself and community in terms of, you know, that revival of language? How important is, you know, language to you first?
Language has always been really important to me, but it's funny because, I would consider myself quite lucky in many ways because my family in particular, just the Gambangia community and people have held on to language. They've had a strong grasp of it throughout colonization, really. So we have access to language, and my grandfather and my great-grandmother, you know, were very fluent in it growing up. So I was hearing them speak it, but it just wasn't something that was taught as a first language within our house. So in terms of my love for language, it's something that has very much grown as I've gotten older. And just realizing, I suppose, that that old language, that old tongue, is much more than just speaking and communicating with people. It's actually about being able to relate to the past, to country, to all of our kin, be that animals, you know, plants, and to each other as well. So they're always very multidimensional in so many ways, and I just love that. It gives me, I suppose, I think language has a special tool in showing people and just making it very evident and unavoidable the fact that we have Aboriginal Australia and all of the nations and clan groups underneath it have always had our own society. We've had our own ways of being and doing and speaking, you know, before the invasion. So I think when you speak language, you are immediately announcing to people that, yes, I come from these people, I come from this land, the country was sung in this language and created this way. And by bringing it forth in the now, you're ensuring that there's a continuous, you know, flow of culture and of identity and things like that too. So I love the fact that language is multidimensional, and I feel like the older that I get, the more I can appreciate those different dimensions and the strength that is within being able to speak your language and being able to, in doing that, you're also, you know, engaging in an act of the resistance and revival, and it becomes so much more than just speaking, you know, and trying to communicate something with someone. It's much more than that. And like every type of, you know, element of our culture, it all relates to each other. It's very holistic and everything has a purpose and a place. And I think language is very much like at the center of how you understand who you are and how you ensure that, you know, we have strong a strong future as well. So it's not an easy, that's never an easy answer, and it's not supposed to be either. I think it would be unfair to talk about language in very simple terms. But I remember also reading, when I was kind of in my early 20s, I started reading a lot of Frantz Fanon, and he was, he has a whole chapter in the Black Skin, White Masks book based on language, and he's you know, done amazing work in colonial psychology, and as a young person, reading his work, it was very important to me to be able to understand my reality, and so that I can navigate it in better ways. But he talked about language as being it being a way, a channel, I guess, in which you you understand and encompass a world. So when you possess language, you possess a new world, and that world translated by language. So I, that kind of was very hit home to me, and it was something that kind of touched me in many ways and made me think, okay, actually, I need to be able to understand and speak my language in order to understand my country and to be able to understand everything that's within it as well. So it's, for me, it's a way of understanding the world, and it's a really important channel to do so. And I don't think that I could ever understand my country properly just in English terms, because it wasn't created in that tongue, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's a, like a really, really good point, because at the moment, there's different places around the country that are sort of going through this discussion of changing from the colonial names back to, you know, the traditional names. When non-Indigenous people try and use, you know, our language, our languages, do you think that there's sort of some context that gets lost within that process,
yeah,
like the underlying meanings and stuff?
For sure. I think it's a real risk when you, because, and this is really something that's quite pertinent to Gumbengi Mob, because Gumbengi communities, we've been the first of the New South Wales State Education's language nest sites. So all of Gumbengi languages become a mandatory learning within high schools, early year high schools, I'm pretty sure, and it's very much integrated now within preschools and public schools. And so our elders fought for the teaching of language, but there has been risks and important concerns around what happens when the teaching of language then moves beyond our control and goes into, you know, school curriculums and environments where non-Indigenous people are teaching it, and they don't have the lived experience or the cultural context behind each word, because, again, it's understanding that language is not just a way of communicating in words. It's about, it's anchored in so much more. It's anchored in very much in a cultural context.
And is that sort of like bordering on more appropriation than necessarily like appreciation? Do you think within those? There's those people that sort of, you know, want to do it because they think they're doing justice or doing the right thing, but they're sort of missing the point altogether?
Definitely. I think it does become something where when you're no longer collaboratively working with Indigenous people on an equitable basis and in practicing certain things and all of that, then yes, it becomes very much, I think it loses a lot of its spirit and integrity as well. So in terms of language, you know, Gumbengi being taught in schools and different settings where there aren't any Indigenous people there to inform people of what that language carries, I think that becomes really risky. And you do, and that's, you know, it's you're on Aboriginal country, and you've got to be able to continuously learn to work with and center Indigenous people within these spaces. And I think, yeah, you can't really just take it and run with it. It's not the point. And it's much, yeah, it's about working with communities and with people particularly. But I think also, like, in saying this as well, you did refer to the current, there's a bit of movement around decolonizing place names and stuff. And that's something that's actually going on here in Grafton, where there's been most recently, like, a bit of a mobilisation to change the name of Coots Crossing, which is a name that was named after a man who committed a massacre against Aboriginal people. So it's a little village just outside of Grafton, and there was an article written in the local paper about the history of it, and that was written by a local Kumbengi woman, Janelle Brown. And a lot of people were shocked that it had even happened, and then some people weren't shocked and they knew about it but were still and are still unwilling to change the name. And I've been kind of trying to get my head in this space, and I've looked around, and a lot of places have been changed around the country, but more so for just, you know, places that are evidently, like, very obviously racist. So whereas I can't really come across many places that have been changed because the person that have been named after a person that was in fact racist. So it's a little bit different than other changes that have been made. And I think there's so many, ultimately I think when you put it to white people to say, do you want to change the name of this town? If you what you're doing is you're testing them and you're giving them an opportunity to see how much better they want to be than their forefathers were, and how they want to move forward, and how they, I think it's a test of maturity ultimately, because either way, if crisscrossing isn't changed, if that name's not changed, Aboriginal people know the history and we're still going to honour those people that were killed. Mm. And so that's not going to change fast, but when you put it to non-Indigenous people to say, well, you do the same, it's very much just saying to them, are you ready to grow up and to start to want to be better and to build, you know? So that's how I see it in many ways, and I feel like anyone who kind of is proud of, you know, their identity being associated with a massacre, a murderer, I think has, you know, some identity issues there.
Yeah.
Which isn't indicative of much broader, you know, mainstream. I would say it's indicative of mainstream Australia as well. So it's like a little, and so they've just had a community meeting on that in Coots Crossing the other night, and I think they're going to be putting it to a vote very much soon. So very interesting, I suppose, in how looking at flipping the gaze and saying to white people, okay, so what's that with your identity now, and how much integrity do you want?
We're just going to head to a song break, but before that there, if you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program this morning is Kalisha Morris, proud Gimbangia and Torres Strait Islander sister, living back home on country, Grafton. We've been yarning about the importance of language and how, you know, language shapes us as Indigenous peoples.
People lost their way. He was very stubborn. He was just a child, and now his life is mystified. Black boy. Ba-dum, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum. to be a man, to live and learn and understand. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but names will never hurt you. You'll be the one who's having fun, so you just keep on learning on.
And that was Emily Waimara with her song, Black Boy. Another thing I want to yarn with you about as well, there's this native academic Mohawk by the name of Taiki Alfred. And he talks about, he's got this really cool video on YouTube. He talks about if he can, I guess, impart more knowledge to his children, then he's making essentially like them more Indigenous than what he is. He's decolonizing them more. Do you think that sort of, that's obviously the process in terms of, you know, relearning this language and passing it on to the next generation as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting perspective, and I'm unfortunately not too familiar with his work in that particular, I suppose, with that theory. My perspective is as well, is the earlier, you know, that you're teaching kids, and if you're teaching the next generation about, you know, how to speak language, how to frame the world and understand the world and how to reference the world according to Gumbengi ways, I think you're going to be building young people who are much more, I suppose, comfortable and secure in their identity, and much more equipped to be able to understand what's going on, the reality of living in the mainstream, you know, white Australia as well. So I think you're definitely, and hopefully you're building them up to a point where they don't have to unravel themselves and deconstruct in as many ways as we've had to do, you know, because that is really difficult work to do on yourself. And you would know, you know, we both have, as young people, we've had to grow up and unlearn lots of behaviours and try to, you know, make sure that when we're unlearning, we have access to the way that we should be, you know, operating, and we've got access to knowledge from the old people in our community and that kind of support. So I think for me, when I'm working with young people, it's about ensuring that they understand that their importance of who they are. They understand who they are. They understand the strength in who they are. They are able to then use that and move forward, and hopefully they'll be much more equipped and stronger in facing the world, you know, as they get older. So I think it's, you know, a lot of it is around just making sure that they, you know, as a big sister and auntie and all of that, it's just about making sure that our children don't have to go through, you know, the deconstruction and all of that that we have had to in order to bring things back. And I think that's really important as well, because the world is pretty harsh and difficult to navigate for our kids and our people, and the less, you know, heavy-duty work that we can give them to do on themselves, the better.
Yeah, I'm really dreading the day that I sort of have that yarn with my daughter, you know, about racism. I always catch myself thinking, like, you know, when I'm at home and we're just playing, like, oh, you know, the day she comes home from school or whatever, she goes, oh, Dad, you know, like, these fellas called me, you know, an abo or a black such and such. What do those words mean? Yeah, that's not a conversation.
You know, yeah.
Because, you know, like, now I'm like, you know, like, before I had a kid, I'm like, yeah, you know, where's these white fellas? I want them to come say something to me. I want to give it back to them. But, yeah, now I'm just like, oh, you know, like, but it is something, you know, that, like, you want to prepare, you know, but then also
it's not necessary. And it sucks that you have to do it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. And then also, you know, her being, you know, a woman as well in this world, you know, preparing her, you know, in this world and, you know, telling her how to watch out for bad men. Hopefully she'll, you know, pick up on those vibes that they are. You know, like we're sort of on, I guess, on the edge of, you know, like the generation before us and the generation before that, you know, like had it bad. It opened up the doors for us to be in certain spaces that we're in today. And so it's like our next generation is sort of, I guess, one less step. But not to say that, you know, colonialism is an ongoing thing that's, you know, going to exist for as long as we are until we dismantle it.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying as well. And in terms of, like, when I'm working with young people, and including, you know, like young people in my own family, and not just teaching them language and ways of, you know, being Gumbangi and trying to tell them more stories about country and get them to know it, I'm also making sure that I'm helping them to understand colonialism and racism in those terms as well, because it's just something, like, it is, these are the, it's really important that young people understand how to organize. I guess it's really important that young people be able to pick apart reality in a situation and figure out where the crux of the problem really lies. And I don't know if you're familiar with an author from the US, her name's Claudia Rankine.
No, I don't think so. No,
she's amazing, and she's got a whole book called Citizen, and it's just full of, like, little excerpts around microaggressions that she's experienced, racial microaggressions, because she's of the belief that it's, you know, not to, she doesn't want to hear about so much the big racial events. That's not something, like, she does, that's important, but she thinks it's very important that you talk about the microaggressions that you experience and all the little things that eat you up and often influence how you feel and how healthy you are as well, on top of, you know, those huge events that capture a lot of people's attention. So I think it's so important to be able to equip our young people with that information about what racism is, what colonialism is, where the problem is coming from, who has the problem, and ensuring that also they're not digesting all of that and internalizing that racism. So it's such a big, like, it's when you're raising, you know, kids and you understand these types of things, it's just really, it's not as easy as, you know, avoiding conversations at all, of course, you know, all those things. And I think it's just, you know, as young people who have had access to all of these amazing, thinkers on racial, you know, theory and things like that, we should be taking it upon ourselves to ensure that those truths and those tools are passed on to the younger people. And I think that's something that's really we can offer. That's great and empowering as well, because flipping that gaze again, I think I wasn't taught to do that growing up when we talked about racism. We just talked about stereotypes and breaking them, and we never looked at the actual where the racism actually really came from and why that person was of those stunted beliefs.
And I remember one time Jade was shopping with her mum Jade's mum sort of lives down the Gold Coast, or just before the Gold Coast, one of those big shopping centres. And, like, they were just minding their own business in passing. Like, baby girl, I think this is when she first learned how to, like, sort of, like, sit up and sort of hold herself up in the pram. And just in passing, like, this lady goes, isn't she a cute little monkey? And then, so Jade sort of had this moment, turned around, and this, like, lady was, you know, still walking. Yeah, then Jade told me, I was like, what the, you know, I was like, man, if I was there and, you know, she said that around me and, you know, I'd, you know, would have pulled her up or said something. But it's like those little things, like, at there. Once you sort of realize it, how many times, like, you actually, like you said, internalize those things, not necessarily knowing the effect, the emotional, mental effect that it had on you as well. And it's,
it's difficult. I mean, you're gonna. I went to a public school with a lot of my cousins around as well, and so I don't, like, I guess that was, you know, in the 1990s and going into high school was in the early millennial period as well. And I was very comfortable because I had a lot of my cousins who were very athletic and they were very tough. And nobody picked on me, no. but also, of course, that doesn't, you know, it doesn't protect you from the curriculum and the institution and the attitudes of the majority of the kids, you know. To fear you is not necessarily understanding you either. And just so that was here in Grafton, and things were very black and white in within the town. But in high school, it wasn't so bad. And then in my senior years, I actually went to a boarding school on scholarship to just try to get myself out of Grafton at that time. And that was full of, there was probably about six or seven Aboriginal girls in that school, and there was maybe one other in my year. So to go from being in a public school with my family members, all my cousins and stuff, to then go to this really wealthy, non-Indigenous, basically, you know, Anglican school, boarding on top of that, was a huge culture shock. And fortunately for me, like, I've always been very confident and very staunch in who I was. And but, like, those high school experiences of being in public and private schools and stuff, like, it's just being that of the 3% of the population, you have to be able to teach your kid that, you know, no matter what environmental situation they're in, there's racism everywhere. And because we're the, you know, the minority, and if, whether it's racial privilege or and prejudice or all of that, it just comes in different forms. And yeah, it's really important that, I guess, we equip our young people to deal with that too. I think we also, I met with youth in Nambucca Heads a little while ago, and because Nambucca, the community of Nambucca, has nominated youth as their priority moving forward, and we talked about the importance of being able to workshop with our young people what racism and colonialism meant, and what white supremacy meant, and, you know, power and privilege and all of that stuff. And it's a really important thing to be able to teach.
We're just going to head to a song break. But before that there, if you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program this morning is Kalisha Morris, proud Gimbangia and Torres Strait Islander sister, living back home on country, Grafton. We've been yarning about the importance of language and how, you know, language shapes us as Indigenous peoples.
Do you have Troy Cassidaly?
Is he Gimbangia?
Yeah, he's Bundjalung, and I think he's got ties to Gimbangia country. But if you can get a hold of that song, that would be good. Okay. Anything by Troy, actually, because he's Grafton, we claim him.
I am Manoia, come limerai o mai. I am Manoia, come limerai o mai. Ya come limerai o mai, o mai, ya come limerai. Travel far from my home because you said that I should go to learn a new way of life, but my spirit remains in Bundjalung. I am Manoia, come limerai o mai. I am Manoia, come limerai. Come a limerite, oh my, ya come a
ne go nak ne dolce vono no ble 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 ul tang dara king ara ul tang dara king ara ul nak ne go nak ne dolce vono no ble 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 ble.
And you're back on 98.9 FM. You are listening to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Bo Spearham, and my guest on the program this morning is our deadly Gambangia Jinder. Yeah, Kalisha Morris. And you follow the Guris, eh? Or no? Yes, we are.
We totally put that G on. Put the G on.
Okay. Yes. That's it. Yeah.
And that's like just from like the North Coast mob, and then you hit Sydney or mid North Coast maybe, and then it becomes Koori.
And mob up here as well, like the Gold Coast, like had a yarn with some of them mob, and they said Gooris, and also.
Oh really?
Yeah, and Stratty mob, some of them say Gooris as well.
Good to know. That's good to know.
Yeah. I think it's like we say Murrays. I don't know, like,
but we don't have K in our language.
Yeah. I talked to some of them and they try to say, no such thing as Gurus. Like, there's old, you know, elders and black fellas saying it, I think they know what they're talking about when they say they're Gurus. But yeah, like where we come from, Murray means man. And Yinna means woman, and that there, so like it always gets me thinking as well, like you know, like everywhere, you know, white fellas go, they'd always, you know, rather talk to men, and I always had this in my head, was like, oh, you know, like did they just go up to, you know these Murrays, these, you know, Gumroi men, and said, oh, who are you, what are you, and I said, oh, we're Murrays.
Mm-hmm.
So like, oh, you're Murrays. Yeah, like it always got me thinking that there, like, is that sort of but I don't know, it might be.
Totally legit theory. That's a really good theory. I've been thinking that myself lately because, you know, like a lot of places that have Aboriginal language names or nicknames that are Aboriginal are basically like it means just this place or here.
Mm.
Like, and then also I was learning about there's a little area called Jackadri, which is just outside of Grafton, west of Grafton, where my actual mother's sacred country kind of homelands are. And the language word for that is very close to Jackadri, and so it also means stand up, which probably meant like when the white fellas probably asked them what the name or the place was, they probably just said like stand up. Or like just instructional types of things as well, and it's like, oh, that's really funny that that's what they take it as. And just goes to show too, like, the, you know, I guess the shallowness of the conversation that was had between two groups, or if it was had at all, you know. They were just listening in. But yeah, that's what I mean, you know, and it's a shame too that, and it's sometimes, like, you know, I'll be driving and you'll go past creek bed names and things like that are English words, and I just think to myself, like, this story, I know this creek bed or I know this river has so much history behind it that is, it goes for, like, you know, tens of thousands of years of history, and yet there's this really, like, foreign name that's just, like, plastered on, just superimposed on top of this river. And so I do think much deeper about place when I'm about and about and understanding it way beyond what the English term is, or even way beyond what the Aboriginal language name apparently is, because of that interaction that was had, you know, where there may have been a misunderstanding about the place name. So yeah, it's super interesting, and like it makes it for when you like, for someone who you look for that type of stuff, like going out on a little drive is never boring because there's always lots of history to learn about, and there's all these little clues and things that you can pick apart and trace and all of that too. So yeah, constantly learning, hey.
And yeah, which sort of brings me back to my next point, something I wanted to ask a while ago as well. You know, like you mentioned, you know, the more you got older, the more sort of appreciation that you got for language. So did that sort of happen when you were off country, or sort of in the development of, you know, you growing up as well?
I think growing up, I had a keen interest in it, and my grandfather, he, when they were growing up, they were taught not to speak it, and so it was banished in many ways. And but he would let like little bits and pieces out here and there. So like if he was watching a footy game or something, he was like getting wild. He would start talking and. I just would hear little bits here and there. Me and I'm always like a love story, so I would go and sit with him. He'd always sit on the veranda, and he still does this day. He just sits outside all day, like a lot of old buffs do that. Yeah. And so you just go, you know, like I'd go and sit down with him and let him tell stories and try to like pick things up that way. And then maybe like I would be feeling lucky and I would just tack in, like I would slide in a slight on the fly, like a little question about what this, what language word was for that, or because he just wasn't, a lot of the, our elders were either didn't learn it or they were like their bodily memories are like not to speak it because it was punitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so even just for them, like teaching it to us now is such a inspiring and courageous thing to do because you've just been conditioned your whole life never not to speak it and teach it. So for me, it was like I knew Pop spoke it. I knew my great, I was very proud because my Pop, Bruce Morris, his grandma, his mother, Maggie Morris from Kempsey Lake, she was fluent in Gungari and Gumbengi, and I'm pretty sure she spoke Bundjalung as well and Yagal. So she had all these languages there. But she was part of the elders group who set up Murubai Language Centre in Nambakkal. And I always knew that too. So just knowing and being proud of that fact that she was part of that group that held language together, I just was like, yep, I'm her granddaughter. I'm like, I have a right to this language. She fought for me to have it.
Mm.
And so I would just pick up things here and there as a kid. And then, then I did move off country and I felt like I'd be isolated because I wasn't going home very much. I went to Sydney to uni and I was just looking for ways in which I could feel closer to my family and to my country.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when I actually started to really try my very best to get materials and start trying to learn more and become more fluent in it. I started doing that off country to be closer to country. So, and then it worked too because, like, I would have a bad day and then I'd come home and all I'd do was, like, go and get some of the materials that the language centre had sent and I'd repeat, like, language and sentences. And I didn't quite even know at that point, like, what I was really saying. I knew the words and I was looking at the materials because, that was what had been sent to me, but it wasn't me speaking it fluently. It was me just repeating it. And trying to like let those words go through my body and spiritually like go somewhere else. And so I automatically would feel like just stronger and better. And so it became like almost like a medicine in a way where I was able to make myself feel better because I knew that once I spoke that language out loud that I was closer to the old people.
Mm.
And that's something that I feel like, yeah, it was a way for me to be in Sydney for as long as I was. And now that I'm back on country, it's actually, there's a whole other element onto it because I'm able to actually go and to, there's Gumbengi Mob are great. They've got like multiple classes that run once a week, a few times a week. We've got the language centre in Nambatha. We've got a whole bunch of people who now speak it so fluently. And all the younger people are learning it as well in the school. So you can guarantee walk down the street and you speak to one of the young kids, say, Ginigay, and, you know, Nyindazaro, how are you? Are you good? They'll speak it back to you because that's what they're learning. So once you're on country and you're speaking it with people and it's just, there's a whole other element to language and speaking it when you're just surrounded by people who are as well. And also this is like our country was sung and created by song and to be able to, that's just like, yeah, it just, it's an amazing feeling, I think, just being able to be on country and speaking it as well. So it's just done so much for me. And and I feel, again, like the more that I learn, the more I feel like I can understand country and then in turn understand myself as country being at the core of who I am. Mm. So it's all very like closely in, closely intertwined, and yeah.
Do you think that like non-Aboriginal people sort of are keen to learn language? They sort of don't understand the struggle that the Molefellas went through, but then also that people like yourself are going through to sort of unravel, go back through the sort of process of learning the language as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure there are non-Indigenous people as well who do understand the history around it, but I think a lot of that isn't taught and does go when you, that's what happens when you're not learning from Indigenous people themselves. And like I said, and I mentioned earlier, like I feel like our elders teaching us language and our aunties and uncles and all that, them, just the act of them teaching us language is a beautiful act, and it's something that is, it's a thing within itself, that you're, you know, the process of it is so just as important as the, as learning it and as the outcome. And I think, you know, like when I'm learning it from Gawa, my Niklo and Niklo Jared and my cousins and my pop, and that now, it just means so much more to me. It's not, again, it's just not language. It's like connection, and it's understanding that I'm receiving a privilege, and this comes from sacrifice, and it comes from love, a place of deep love, and all of that. So I do think, again, like if there is, and like, you know, the thing is when non-Indigenous people don't get that, they lose out as well. And so it's something that I feel, you know, is definitely underappreciated, that you have to be able to ensure that when you're learning about Aboriginal culture, history, language, it's so much more than knowledge. It's actually about the process of learning and where knowledge should be coming from, and what that actually means by the reproduction of knowledge and the act of passing it on. And because it's just, you know, it's never as simple as just learning something.
You just said it there. It's not just the language. It's a connection to each other as Kimbangia people, but then also to the land as well, and the things that have sort of been sown in within that land. Like you said, that was sung up as well.
Yeah, and yeah, like, and then, you know, it's an act of resistance and revival and all of that too. And I do think that it's important to keep pushing that message out there to people, because and you want to, if you're going to, you know, bring something back, then you do it the right way so that it has integrity. Mm. And I feel like a lot of non-Indigenous people in Australia miss that. They miss that, the depth to everything that they is around them, and the depth that, to the land that they stand on. And it just does nothing for our building, any type of opening up a chance for us to come together in a way that honours country. Because at the end of the day, like, my priority is country as well. Mm. And yeah, so you're definitely like, I think it's important to always bring that up as well, to understand that there is a process that is going on. And a lot of the time, a lot of non-Indigenous people try to skip that, and they take and ultimately empty out a lot of, you know, the whole process, and empty language, and, you know, all of that too. So.
And that was part one of my interview with Kleisha Morris about language revival, NAIDOC, and also our young mob. I remember to tune in tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. on 98.9 FM for the second part of our interview.